All right, let's dive deep into a case today that's, well, it's kind of a bedrock for anyone even thinking about civil rights law, especially when we're talking about folks behind bars.
Yeah, for sure.
Haynes v. Kerner, Supreme Court, 1972, right?
You got it.
It might sound simple on the surface, but this one really changed the game for how courts handle lawsuits from prisoners who, you know, don't have a lawyer.
Right, filing pro se, as we say.
Exactly, pro se litigants. So, no lawyer in prison trying to navigate the legal system, what could go wrong?
Well, that's exactly what Haynes v. Kerner tries to address, making sure those folks get a fair shake, that the lack of a fancy law degree doesn't shut them out completely. It's all about procedural fairness.
Procedural fairness. Okay, I like that. So break it down for us. Who is this Francis Haynes, and how did he end up at the Supreme Court?
All right, so picture this. Francis Haynes, inmate at the Illinois State Penitentiary, decides to sue.
Bold move.
Right. He files this pro se lawsuit, and he's using a pretty powerful tool, 42 U.S.C. section 1983.
Now, that one comes up a lot.
All the time. It's a big one for civil rights cases. Basically, it lets you sue state officials if you think they violated your constitutional rights.
Okay, so Haynes is going after some serious players here.
Oh, yeah. He's aiming high the governor of Illinois and other state officials.
Whoa.
Yeah, and he's saying they messed up, caused him injuries, violated his rights, all while he was stuck in solitary confinement.
Solitary. Man, that just screams potential rights violations.
Yeah.
What exactly was he claiming happened?
So it all started with a fight. Apparently, there was some kind of altercation with another inmate. A shovel was involved. You know, prison stuff.
Sounds rough.
Yeah. And after that, boom, solitary confinement for Haynes. His lawsuit boils down to two main points. One, he says being forced to sleep on the floor with just blankets in solitary made an old foot injury and some circulatory problem way worse.
Okay, that tracks. Yeah. Solitary is no joke.
Nope. And his second point is about the disciplinary hearing, the one that landed him in solitary in the first place. He's claiming they didn't give him due process, you know, a fair chance to defend himself.
So he's in solitary, hurting, and feeling like the whole process was rigged. What happened when he tried to get a court to listen?
Well, here's where things get interesting. The first court, the U.S. District Court, they just dismissed his lawsuit. Poof, gone.
Just like that.
Pretty much. They use this thing called Rule 12b-6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah, legalese for you didn't make a strong enough case, so we're tossing it out. Basically, even if everything Haynes said was true, they didn't see a legal basis to give him any kind of remedy.
So even if his story checked out, no dice, seems harsh, especially for someone representing himself. Did he even get a chance to show evidence, you know, back up his claims?
That's the thing, right? They dismissed it super early just based on what he wrote in his complaint.
So no chance to plead his case, to really make his argument.
Not really, no. And to make matters worse, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals backed up the lower court's decision. They basically said, yeah, we agree, not a strong enough case. And anyway, prison officials get a lot of leeway in how they run things.
So the lower courts are essentially saying, look, Mr. Haynes, we hear you, but we're siding with the prison on this one. Yikes. That raises some serious questions about access to justice, right? If you don't have a lawyer, do you even have a shot?
Exactly. And that's where the Supreme Court comes in. They saw a problem and they said, hold on, we need to take a closer look at this.
Big leagues now.
Yeah. They granted certiorari, meaning they agreed to hear the case, which is a big deal. They only pick certain cases from the lower courts, ones with big legal questions that need answering. And they even appointed a lawyer for Haynes.
Oh, wow. So they're taking this seriously. They're sensing something's off with how the lower courts handle it.
Exactly. It's like they're saying, we need to make sure this guy gets a fair hearing, a real chance to make his case.
Okay, so Supreme Court steps in, ready to sort things out. What was the big legal question they were trying to untangle?
They zeroed in on this. Can a district court just dismiss a lawsuit from a prisoner who doesn't have a lawyer right at the beginning without giving them a chance to actually prove their claims?
That seems like a big question. Like, are we going to prioritize procedure over someone's potential rights being violated?
Yeah, it gets to the heart of fairness in the legal system. And what did the Supreme Court decide?
Give it to us straight. What'd they say?
They said, nope, this isn't right. They reversed the lower courts, and that's where the whole foundation of Haynes v. Kerner comes in. They said, plain and simple, that pro se pleadings, you know, the legal documents those folks file without a lawyer, they can't be held to the same super strict standards as if a lawyer wrote them.
Okay, so a little more leeway, a little more understanding, but what does that mean in practice? How much leeway are we talking?
It means the courts have to look at these pro se complaints with a more generous eye. They can't expect perfect legal language, precise citations, all that jargon. They have to really dig in and try to understand what the person is trying to say, even if it's messy. We call that liberally construing the complaint.
So a judge can't just toss it out because the grammar's bad or they didn't cite the exact right law.
Exactly. The Supreme Court actually set a high bar for dismissal. They said you can only dismiss a pro se complaint if it's absolutely clear beyond doubt that there's no way the person could prove their case.
Beyond doubt. That sets a pretty high standard.
It does.
So let's get into the nitty-gritty here. What was the Supreme Court's reasoning? What led them to this decision?
Well, they looked back at a case from 1957, Conley v. Gibson, which set a similar standard for all complaints. Conley said a complaint shouldn't be dismissed unless it's totally clear that the plaintiff can't prove their case. And Haynes built on that, saying this is even more important when you're dealing with someone who doesn't have a lawyer. And, you know, beyond the legal technicalities, the court was sending a message about fairness. They were worried that if they didn't step in, people with legitimate claims, especially those stuck in prison, would be denied justice just because they couldn't afford a lawyer or navigate the system perfectly.
So they're taking this principle from Conley and saying it applies even more strongly to prisoners representing themselves. It's like they're adding an extra layer of protection.
Exactly.
And how did that apply to Haynes' specific situation? What about his claims made the court say, hold up, this needs a second look?
Sure. So Haynes' complaint, maybe it wasn't the most polished legal document, but it did raise some serious issues. He's talking about physical harm from the conditions in solitary, and he's saying he didn't get a fair disciplinary hearing. The court recognized that those claims, even if not perfectly articulated, could point to real constitutional violations.
So the content, the substance of his claims, was enough to warrant a closer look.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about the legal technicalities.
Right. And dismissing him without a chance to present evidence, to really explain himself, well, that could have meant denying justice to someone whose rights were actually violated. And that goes against the whole idea of due process, you know, that everyone deserves a fair shot in court.
It seems like the court was trying to strike a balance here. They want to make sure the courts are accessible, that anyone can seek justice, but they also have to respect the way prisons operate. There's got to be some order, some deference to the authorities.
Right. You hit the nail on the head. There's this tension between making sure prisons can function and making sure individual rights aren't trampled on. And the Seventh Circuit, remember, they really lean towards giving prison officials a lot of leeway.
Right. They emphasize that. So how did the Supreme Court handle that tension?
They acknowledge that prisons need some breathing room, that courts shouldn't be micromanaging every decision, but they said that discretion isn't unlimited. It doesn't give prison officials a free pass, especially when someone's claiming actual harm, like Haynes was, there needs to be some oversight.
So yes to some deference, but not a blank check. There still needs to be accountability. Okay, so Haynes v. Koerner, it's a 1972 case. Why are we still talking about it? Why does it still matter today?
It matters because pro se prisoner lawsuits haven't gone anywhere. We're still talking about thousands of these cases filed every year. And Haynes is the rule book. It's the precedent that says judges have to give these folks a fair shake. It's a safeguard against those cases getting tossed out too quickly just on a technicality.
So it's not just a history lesson. It's still very much alive in the legal world.
Absolutely.
Now, for someone studying law, what are the big takeaways here? What should they be thinking about in terms of Haynes v. Koerner?
Two big things. One, remember that liberal construction idea. When you see a pro se complaint, especially from a prisoner, don't get hung up on the way it's written. Dig deeper. Try to understand the core issue, the claim they're trying to make.
Look beyond the surface.
Exactly. And two, remember that no set of facts test from Conley that Haynes reinforced. It might have been tweaked since then, but it shows how pleading standards have evolved and why it's so important to consider the context, who's filing, what resources they have. I actually remember early in my career, I had this case where a handwritten complaint from an inmate was about to get dismissed just because it was hard to follow. But remembering Haynes, we really dug in and found a potential due process violation that the court had missed. It ended up making a real difference for that guy.
Wow, that's a perfect example of Haynes in action, right?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing the person behind the messy legal filing.
Yeah, and it's a reminder that even though the exact rules might change, that core principle of fairness from Haynes is timeless.
So even though Haynes focuses on prisoner lawsuits, it feels like it speaks to a bigger idea about access to justice, right? making sure the system works for everyone, not just those who can afford a lawyer.
Definitely. Haynes is a reminder that the rules should help people get justice, not create more obstacles. And that's especially important for folks who are already facing so many barriers, like those who are incarcerated. It's about making sure everyone has a voice, regardless of their circumstances.
So, Haynes v. Koerner, bottom line. It's about making sure the courthouse doors are open, even for those without a lawyer, especially for prisoners trying to navigate a complex system.
And it's about recognizing that everyone deserves a fair shot, a chance to be heard. That's the heart of procedural fairness.
It makes you think, though, about the practical side of it, right? Courts are swamped, and a lot of these pro se complaints are really complex. How do judges handle that? How do they apply this liberal construction idea without getting bogged down? What are the challenges there? That's something to ponder as you continue your legal studies and think about the kind of legal world you want to be a part of. And also, how have things changed since Haynes? Have later cases like Twombly made it harder for pro se litigants to get their foot in the door? These are questions worth exploring, and Haynes v. Koerner gives us a great starting point. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Anytime. Glad to be here.